God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the 85th episode of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. It's amazing we've made it this far, and I really mean it is amazing that we've made it this far. So today we will be discussing Amazing Spider-Man, starring Andrew Garfield, Emma Stone, and directed by Mark Webb. We will then be discussing why Hollywood felt Spider-Man was in need of a reboot just 5 short years after Spider-Man was released, starring Tobey Maguire. And then we will top things off with our top 5 performances we did not expect to be good, and how that ties into our opinion of Spider-Man remains to be seen.
You're going to stay with your aunt and uncle for a little while. You'll be safe here.
Where are you going?
Something your mom and I have to do.
I want to go with you.
Yeah, we have to go.
So, gentlemen.
Now, who's we?
Oh, yeah, we... Oh, geez, 85 episodes and I don't even know to introduce ourselves. I'm Lee Carlo. I'm here with Chapin Hemingway and Tyson. Thank you, Tyson, for correcting me.
No sweat.
I got a few topics that I'd like to discuss, although, Tyson, you suggested that you may have some interesting questions. So I'll pass it over to you.
I had some stuff that I wanted to discuss. I had two specific tie-in questions I thought maybe we could cover. My first was to ask you guys what you think warrants booting a franchise, and then the second was whether or not wanting your own interpretation of a known story or character justifies.
Start that over again. What did you say?
Let's hold off on those, because that'll tie into our next discussion. So in the meantime, with The Amazing Spider-Man, I think I'll just start with kind of the obvious thing here, because this movie, like so many of these comic occasions and these superhero movies, was formulaic. And we've had huge issues with that in the past, to the point that it pretty much ruined 2011 for all of us. But I'm wondering how you guys felt formula worked with The Amazing Spider-Man.
JP, you should talk about that, because we saw the movie together. And
I'm sorry, you guys kind of broke up there. Which formula are you talking about?
The formula they use with these comic book movies that was just the same in so many of the movies, especially last year, that we criticized. You know, the ordinary guy, right? And then something happens, and just the
This is going to tie into our reboot discussion, but I just have to get it off the table because it's the most obvious critique I have of this film. But for most of this movie, I looked at it and I felt, why are we seeing this again? It's the same exact story that we saw in 2002 with the original Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire Spider-Man, and it was the same story, and that frustrated me. But I have to say, if I were an omniscient studio executive and these movies were both made side by side and were presented to me, I would have picked The Amazing Spider-Man over the Raimi Maguire Spider-Man. I thought this did a much better job at telling a story that we're all too familiar with. And Leon, I think that you kind of hit it on the head. This is a formulaic and typical storyline in the superhero universe, not to mention in the Spider-Man universe. So not only is it sort of a little bit redundant as a storyline in a global sense, but also in the purview of this particular character.
I mean, it absolutely is formulaic, but I think the interesting thing is, especially considering our harsh critiques of that formula in the past, is that I didn't really think of that aspect of this, or that this movie was overly formulaic until, you know, maybe the day after I saw it. I don't really remember thinking too much about that formula while I was watching it, which I think is a little bit of a credit to the movie in the sense that, like, you know, it had enough going on and it had enough working for itself to allow you to forget the ABCs of making a superhero movie, which is good because, you know, this... Again, I totally agree. This is a better movie than the Spider-Man movie, the original Spider-Man movies, which I think are amazingly overrated. But I think this had more going on. I think the acting was better. I think the storytelling was better. I think the mise-en-scene better. And I don't know if Mark Webb is a better director than Sam Raimi. I've never been a huge fan of Raimi's movies, but that's most of those are the Evil Dead movies. But overall, I think this movie did okay, but it had a lot of problems, which we'll get into, I'm sure. But Tyson, what were your initial thoughts, at least on the formula of this movie?
Yeah, I kind of agree with what Chapin was saying, although I don't just bother sitting next to Chapin, and on a couple of different occasions I heard him repeat that we had already seen this thing, and really the way that this story is told, where you have an ordinary guy and he... you know, inherits or develops this power and then gets to know stuff, but more specifically the way that it happened, down to specifics, like, you know, he's on a sort of not a field trip in this one, but, you know, he goes and visits this facility, gets bit by the spider, or, you know, there's a school who he has this friction with and all that stuff. But I think that it wasn't as egregious to me as maybe it has been in other movies that we've talked about in the past couple of months, just because I thought that they kind of did a better, it was a little bit more believable. Something about the Raimi story, it was a little too, like, glossy or too, I don't know, it seemed a little bit too upbeat for me, and this one seemed a little bit more realistic, at least for the first half of the movie. I think it certainly fell off as the movie progressed, but I don't quite think that this that sort of negative formulaic component that we've really pinpointed in the past was as glaring in this maybe as it had been, just because I think they kind of did a better job with some of those components. And having said that, I think I agree with what Jamin was saying, in that they could have told this story, but, you know, focused on different elements. And I understand that this is, you know, maybe the most, you know, or at least one of the most beloved comic book characters of all time, and so they want to focus on staying true to that story and that core material. And so they're trying to focus in on specific events, but I would prefer to have seen not just the different interpretation of these events, but maybe other events that take place that haven't been focused on as much within that backstory.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the kind of how you felt about the look and the feel of the movie and the mood of the movie at the beginning, because the pacing of this movie was something that caught my attention. And I do think maybe it has something to do with what you said, Chapin, that we've seen this movie before. So I felt like a lot of maybe the first 45 minutes I was thinking, get on with it. Like, but this movie felt like it kind of dragged its feet. Like, it didn't really want to get to the exciting aspects of this movie. And it crossed my mind that maybe they didn't want this to be as big and as, like, didn't want to be the Avengers, so to speak. It didn't want to be over the top and big and CGI heavy and just like this action scene after action scene, that it wanted to draw some things out and maybe follow the formula of Batman Begins a little bit, where you really see in a little bit more detail the origins of this character. But the original Spider-Man, good or bad, did that too. So the pacing of this movie felt slow, and then by the time we finally get around to, like, the conflict, I don't know. I was kind of thinking, like, all right, this movie's got to be almost over, right? And it was. Like, everything seemed to speed up and wrap itself up quickly by the end, which left me with a lot of loose ends.
I think that's a great point, Lee, and I really felt that way. You know, it was so drawn out with the drama with his aunt and uncle and how he was feeling about his dad and getting to know Dr. Connors, who eventually becomes the Lizard, and getting to know Gwen and all of this stuff. And then I felt like one of the most dramatic or noticeable speed jumps for me was when all of a sudden he went from surfing those spandex things on the internet to that shot of him where he's looking at his reflection glass. And it in the span of about 30 seconds, he was all of a sudden Spider-Man in this, you know, really technical suit that he, I am assuming, made for himself. And I felt like they really, really, you know, fast-tracked some of those points. And then all of a sudden, the Lizard was this, you know, diabolical character with all of this stuff, and they were just jumping to those key conflict scenes. And, you know, all of a sudden, Cleary didn't have a problem with him at the end. And I just felt like that all happened so quick. They had sort of drugged their feet at the beginning. And so they really just had to wrap it up really fast at the end. And I think that's where it went from being a decent movie to me to just being an all right movie that had some things about it that I liked.
Well, it's funny. And I talk about loose ends, and you mentioned they like quickly the Dr. Connors becomes the Lizard, but like I feel like that was something that they paid a ton of attention to. They made sure that we understood exactly how this medicine or like this whatever it was worked and how he became a Lizard, yet how Andrew Garfield, Peter Parker, becomes Spider-Man isn't really explained. We see him get bit by a spider. I mean, I'm sure we've all gotten bit by a spider once or twice in our life, I haven't jumped off any rooftops lately, but I have, you know, I'm pretty sure I don't have quite the skills that Parker all of a sudden gets. And like, you're supposed to just buy into this like cross species thing that just happened to work out with him because they explain it with this thing that Dr. Connors has been developing. So that's what I mean. Like, that was the beginning of like the loose ends for me. And it,
right.
The same problem existed in the other Spider-Mans that like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. And I vowed not to do this, but I put myself in a bad position when I watched Batman Begins and The Dark Knight back to back last night. Watching Batman Begins, and granted, you know, Batman is not a superhero in the sense that he has superpowers, but like his progression from Bruce Wayne to becoming Batman in that movie is so believable and so realistic, and the attention to the detail of like his growth as a crime fighter, so to speak, is perfect. And, you know, if there's a flaw in Batman Begins, it might be a little bit with Ra's al Ghul and, like, his motivations and, like, what the League of Shadows really is. They have a few lines of dialogue that explain it. But, you know, that's the villain, not the hero. And yet in Spider-Man, it's kind of backwards. Like, maybe we've seen Spider-Man before, so it's more important to focus on creation of this villain, which, you know, is not what an audience wants.
Yeah.
Well, here, I think that you're look, I mean, I totally agree. I think a more proponent of movies being, especially in these type of movies, being more realistic than anything. But you've got to sort of, I guess, as reviewers, if we're trying to be as unbiased as possible, we have to sort of look at the way that the tone of the movie, you know, kind of how they go about things. And Tyson and I were discussing this last night, just around. In a bar with a couple of beers with some friends, like about the Avengers, and I mean, I'm
a couple of friends. I already don't believe your story now.
Okay, ha ha ha. So you know, I don't really like movies like that, but that's what comic books are in a sense. This sort of unbelievable and superpowers. I mean, they are called.
Yeah, you should use your Iron Man and Thor analogy. That was a good one.
I just what that they're just invincible.
Well, just that that where's the draw in that?
Right. Well, I talked about that on the Avengers podcast, so that's why I didn't bring it up. But like, yeah, there's not any stakes, you know, because everybody's invincible. Like, where's the tension? But I mean, that's just who those characters are. So, you know, within that context, like that movie, you know, the Avengers is pretty good. But I mean, I guess I kind of forgive. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of the original Spider-Man trilogy, but I really like the second one. But those movies do have like a certain tone to them. You know, they are a little bit camp and a little bit kitschy, but they sort of work in that sense. Like, they stick to that really well, and Sam Raimi certainly has developed that from his Evil Dead days. Nobody here is a fan of those, but it's a style that I think he's made very conducive to the blockbuster superhero genre. But I think that what really went wrong with The Amazing Spider-Man, and I don't think it really went wrong necessarily, is you sort of bounce back and forth between those two things. Is this realistic? Is this a performance? Are we more interested in, like, the deep details of Peter Parker and who he's become? Or are we going for that sort of camp, funny nature of it? And I think they were more on the more serious side. But then when things sort of develop all of a sudden, when things sort of accelerate because they have to for the purposes of the plot, you really lag behind. Because we don't need to know all that stuff. I mean, Lee, you know the Spider-Man story. That's in everybody's consciousness, not only because there's been a movie made before about it, but because we haven't even read the comic books, but we know the origins of that character just because he's so ubiquitous in media nowadays. So I think the point is that we don't really need to know that stuff, but when it is then suddenly accelerated within the context of the movie, it's just like, you know, what's happening? It doesn't stick to sort of the feeling of the movie.
Right, and then that's a perfect example then. If they're going to just gloss over something because we already know it, then what's the point of the first hour of this movie? And I mean, we all agree on that. You know, I'm not asking you guys to defend it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would agree with you guys if I thought that previous incarnations of this story had touched on aspects that they were trying to touch on. But everything about the relationship between Peter's dad and Dr. Connors and how the formulation of that, you know, that or the development of that formula that allowed Dr. Connors to have that breakthrough, you know, essentially permitted this cross species genetic breakthrough or whatever it was that they had. I mean, that whole subplot was one that was very specific to this story and not one that we had dealt with before. And I thought that, you know, like Lee said, that was a big part of where I felt like there were some loose ends, like what had really happened with his parents. And, you know, I didn't think that really paid off when all of a sudden, after what we're supposed to assume has been 16 years or however, you know, of work for Dr. Connors, this formula just appears, as does the long lost son of his dead partner, and he's able to have this huge breakthrough. And I felt like that was something that they glossed over when it might have been more interesting. You know, they could have focused on those things. And for me, that's what I would want to see in a reboot, is something that's a little bit, I mean, I know he is a superhero and he has superpowers, but something that's a little bit more rooted in believability. And we see that we have to agree that there are somewhat fantastical scenarios that we're watching in the Batman films, but having said that, they're all rooted in some type of realism. I mean, I don't think it's that practical that some of the stuff that happens in them, you know, we would expect to see happening, but they try and make it as believable as possible. And I thought that towards the start of this movie, they really tried to do that. And then they just had this shift because, you know, they were at a certain point in the movie where they needed to start making stuff happen.
Yeah.
Lee, let me ask you something. What do you like about movies like this? I mean, I know you're not like the biggest fan. You and Jeremy especially aren't the biggest fan of these comic book type movies. But when they're good, like what do you get out of them? What do you like about them? What's your motivation for seeing a movie like this? Like, for your own enjoyment?
I mean, I think it's important for, and this is going to tie into something I want to run by you guys, but I think it's important for directors and writers of these adaptations to take some liberties. Like, I mean, the comic books are beloved, I'm sure, and there are going to be people who criticize anything changed about them, just as Harry Potter fans criticize the movies, you know? But, like,
absolutely.
Some of those
I do have to say, like, just to interrupt you, I want you to keep going because I know I asked the question, but I hate it when they talk about that stuff on, like, DVD interviews. Like, oh, yeah, we've been really true to the source material. Well, you shouldn't. It's a comic book. It's a book. You're not supposed to be dedicated to it. You're supposed to make a movie. Take the source material, take what works out of it, and then use it. And then, excuse me, screw the fanboys. They're a bunch of nerds without jobs. Nobody gives a crap.
I mean, pretty, yeah.
Like, all the nerds on Reddit, like, oh no, we're going to destroy this movie because they got Thor's hammers wrong. No!
Okay, tell us how you really feel.
Well, it just drives me nuts.
Jesus, take it easy. Look, I don't think that it has to be that way, though. I mean, you can stay true to the source material but omit stuff where it's not practical. I think that the Lord of the Rings adaptation is as good an example of how to adapt great and very well-liked or beloved source material, and they left out huge portions of those stories just because it wasn't practical or necessary to delve into them. And of course, some people were up in arms saying, oh, you didn't have, you know, the House of Tom Bombadil or whatever important stuff that they felt, but people are always going to feel that way. I just think that there's a good balance. I don't think that you have to disregard it entirely.
I mean, the adaptation argument can be had to death. Like, there, I mean, for good and bad. I mean, there's two books come to mind for me, and one I've all but finished reading is Sideways, which is totally different than the book. I mean, than the movie, and the movie is I think way better. It's to borrow a phrase from Sideways, it's more congealed, much tighter. But anyway, and then another one is Bring Down the House, about the MIT kids who took Vegas, and that movie was completely different, and it sucked. So, you know, good and bad. The directors and writers need to take liberties, and for whatever reason, with a book, they're not afraid to do it. Yet with a comic, you know, it's hallowed ground. It's untouchable. So that's what I expect, and whether that expectation has come from Christopher Nolan's work or not, I want to see something that goes beyond maybe the glitz and glamour of these comic books, where these heroes are just like absolute heroes. And I want to kind of, I don't know if that completely answers your question, but I'll kind of pose a thought to you guys that will extend this conversation there, and has to do with Mark, who directed this, and he previously directed 500 Days of Summer, which, you know, is not a edgy or controversial movie at all, but it definitely is kind of a different take on relationships and happy endings and such. And I kind of wanted to throw this by you about the risks or lack thereof that Mark Webb takes and that these movies take. And two examples come to mind. And one is just, you know, and it follows the formula, and I'm sure it follows the comic, but, you know, Peter Parker helps the poor kid getting beat up by the jock at the beginning because Peter Parker's such a good guy, and so he's going to be such a good superhero. You know, he's going to have no second thoughts whatsoever about helping other people just because he has the power to do so. And I just think that, like, maybe if there was something unlikable about him, there would be a little bit more depth. And yes, it would be controversial to maybe take a character that's already been created and completely ironed out and change something about him. But, I mean, Christopher Nolan does some things with Bruce Wayne that make him a bit unlikable in Batman Begins. And it adds layers to his character that play into his movies, not just that one, but the next one. And I'm sure The Dark Knight Rises. And then the next one, I don't want to spoil anything, but I think you guys will know where I'm talking about. And I knew it wasn't going to happen, but I wanted the movie to either end or leave something like this. But towards the end, when Gwen approaches Peter at his house after, you know, after the climax of the movie, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And he says, you know, X to her. And, you know, the scene looks as if it's about to end, but then she turns around and says something. And I wanted so badly for her not to say that. I wanted so badly for this to be left there.
Yeah.
And add a little bit of, like, you know, I was torn there. I was thinking, like, no, you can't leave it like that. No, she should respond to this. Like, you want so badly for her to understand, yet it makes for a better movie if she doesn't. It creates a controversy, and apparently in the comics, Gwen is killed by the Green Goblin, which is interesting because I was just going to say that. And I'm not saying you have to kill her off. I'm not saying you have to go that far, but honestly, take some risks. Do something that the comics didn't do for the sake of your movie, and that's what I expect from these movies, Chapin, to answer your question.
Yeah,
Father. I am not our father. There are so few Vulcans left. We cannot afford to ignore each other.
Then why did you send Kirk aboard when you alone could have explained the truth?
Because you needed each other. I could not deprive you of the revelation of all that you could accomplish together. Of a friendship that will define you both in ways you cannot yet realize.
Is wanting your own interpretation of a known story or character enough to remake a movie that is already beloved? So, just to use an example, and this is the first one that popped into my mind, I don't think anybody asked for a sequel to the original Willy Wonka. I think that that movie stands on its own, and I think it's a great, it's always been one of my favorite movies. It was my favorite movie growing up. But I think that Tim Burton had an idea for how he saw remaking a story. And I'm wondering if that's enough to justify, you know, if Chris Nolan knew that he had this vision for what he could do with a Batman franchise, is that enough to reboot it if the original stands up?
Well, I mean, I'll answer your question, but let's keep this aspect brief only because I know we've had the sequel remake discussion a million times before. I mean, the Prometheus podcast and the Men in Black 3. Yeah. And then when we discussed Jane Eyre, because that movie's been made like 50 times.
50
like,
times, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we've had this discussion before, and our answer is always a movie is a movie is a movie. And if you have your own interpretation and you feel like you can do it better, then by all means, make it. I'm totally for that. I think, you know, Chapin, I'll let you answer Tyson's question, but then we can maybe go from there with this, in that, like, I think what maybe is creating some buzz here is that the Spider-Man 3 came out in 2007, and now 5 years later they're rebooting it. And the question is, why so soon? And for me, my answer is the same. I mean, why not? Like, it's not the same people. Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire aren't making another one, even if they were. You know, the Capote movie and In Cold Blood, is I think that's what was the other one called? Was it called In Cold Blood?
No, isn't it called Notorious or something?
Yeah, Notorious. They came out like in the same year, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, make your movie, by all means. If somebody's going to pay for it, make it. I mean, I totally get your question. Like, is it enough to... wanting to have your own interpretation enough to make it, should it be? I guess is another question. I mean, maybe there should be some more criteria, because remakes and reboots aren't and haven't always been better. I mean, look at Superman. You know, that was a bomb, a huge bomb. The Hulk is failing. There's kind of two answers there, I suppose. Yeah, you can do it, but maybe you shouldn't.
Yeah, man, I don't really, Tyson, what is your opinion?
Well, I don't know. I think that I kind of agree with Lee that if you have, I think it's worth it. I mean, I think if you're in a position where you can do it, there's nothing wrong with trying. And I think that there have certainly been situations where it's hit and then where it's missed, but I would rather have someone make a movie, and I mean, I think it's kind of win-win for the fans of original movies, because if the movie doesn't hold up, you can always say, well, you know, that makes sense, and I still love the original for this reason, and it's fine, and if it does, if they go out and they impress you, and it's a new interpretation of a story that you already invested in, and then you love, then that's a great thing, and so. For me, I think that it's okay. I think focusing on
Look, I mean, here is like I think the best way to describe it, and it's a huge generalization. But if it was universally agreed upon that like you shouldn't reboot something or you shouldn't remake something or like because they're afraid somebody's gonna remake the Mona Lisa or you know like if universally everyone agrees to say like look this story has been told. Leave it as it is. It's had its place in the history of cinema. Then in 2 weeks' time, we would not be wetting ourselves in the theater for Dark Knight Rises.
Of course. Look, I mean, you know what I mean? We're like, not going to make any rules.
Right. Like, make your movie and yeah, sure. Sometimes it doesn't pay off, like, and probably more often than not. But when it does, like, what Christopher Nolan has done for Batman has changed, like, everyone's perspective on superhero movies. That's why there are so many, because those movies are good. And whatever, like, part of me thinks that some part of these directors are trying to make a movie as good as those movies, whether or not their hand is forced into something formulaic and bad, or they're just not as talented as Christopher Nolan. But, you know, that's the bar that's been set, and it's because Christopher Nolan had his own vision in movies, and without it, we would be, and not that the original Batman is bad, but we would be talking about Tim Burton as the creator of the Batman movies.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good point. Okay, but here's what I'll say. I think you get away with it with these type of characters, because Batman is a perfect example. He's a character that's been around long enough that it's gone through a couple different maturations. Even in the comic book form, there were darker sides to him and lighter sides to him. And, you know, you look at what has been done with that particular character, and, you know, like it or not, I think Tim Burton found an interesting thing to do with Batman early on. You know, obviously that either turned or was completely taken in a totally different direction by Joel Schumacher in the last two. But, you know, Burton's vision and Nolan's vision are so different, but they both work with that character. So I think that works. But the other argument I would give to you, Lee, is that, I mean, I don't think there should be rules against anything. I mean, I think you should be able to do whatever you want. But to a certain extent, you know, if you're endorsing it by going to see it, you know, you've told the studio you want more. And, you know, it seems like it's the ultimate in recycling of ideas. Like, you've got these certain – are we just going to have a constant Spider-Man story going at all times? Like, are they going to reboot it again? You know, I mean, how long will they – but Lee, let me ask you this. We know that Nolan is done with Batman after The Dark Knight Rises this summer. I mean, how long do you think it is going to be till Warner Brothers, having made, you know, a couple – you know, almost probably close to $5 billion when it's all said and done off of this new reboot, how long do you think it's going to take till they do it again?
Well, honestly, the last Twilight isn't even out yet, and they're already – yeah, the last Twilight's not even out yet, and Lionsgate is already talking about a reboot.
Right, it's just like the next step. And here's what I'll tell
really
you this.
I really think it is.
The problem with a reboot is, with these characters, what's so great about them, and what I think, like, Christopher Nolan really, like, honed in on and looked at what had been done with the character in the past and really exploited in that sense, is that we know the characters. We know them. That's why Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man, felt so redundant to me, is that we know this character. We know him already. So when we went and saw the original, what's that origin story, it was redundant then. So seeing it again is just ridiculous. So if you have to reboot and then reintroduce the character, go screw yourself, because we're not interested. We know how this character's developed. So take that and explore that in a different way. Assume society knows how Spider-Man came to be and do something interesting with it, which I think – I mean, that's what's really interesting about what Nolan did, and why I think Batman Begins remains the best of the Nolan movies. I obviously haven't seen the third one yet, but because that's actually really interesting to see how he came about. And Nolan explored that with, like, a really fine eye for it. So my point is that, you know, I think the reboots are great. They have to be – I know I don't think they're great, but you have to do something different with it. You have to, like, look at it in a different way. And it has to be – there has to be a vision to it that hasn't been done before. Like, I think, like, you know, J.J. Abrams kind of, like, streamlined Star Trek in a way, like, made it more accessible for people, which is great. And – how the characters came to be was never really explored before. But you've got this, like, mythology that you can exploit. It doesn't make sense to go back and reintroduce the mythology, you know?
So, Jabin, yeah. I have a quick question for you, because we should move on.
Right.
But you weren't on this podcast, and I have this question just because of your opinion on how this was the same. It was telling the same story as the other Spider-Man. How did you feel about Girl with a Dragon Tattoo?
Well, again, that came to mind in this sense. I actually didn't see the entire Swedish Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, but again, I had a similar feeling. You know, I, as a Fincher fan, want to see him do something really, really interesting. And I, you know, that movie wasn't. I didn't understand why he made the movie, why he decided to make the movie after the success of The Social Network before seeing the movie. And then afterwards, there was no more light shed on it. You know what I mean?
Right. And I mean, Jeremy's response was that he felt like he had seen the movie before, which is the same as yours with Spider-Man. And I do that's an interesting argument. I mean, you could argue that Fincher was trying to make that story more accessible to American audiences. And my response to that would be, shame on American audiences. Watch the Swedish version. Like, right. You read subtitles. But, I mean, it is a similar comparison in the differences in the movies. And that came to mind just with your argument that you are watching the same movie. So then, you know, the question of what's the point becomes even more prevalent.
Exactly. I mean, I in my mind, I mean, look, I like the movie. I actually own it, and I like his vision for it. But you know, from the perspective of a Fincher fan, I don't really understand why he made the decision to make that movie. I wish that he didn't. I wish that he would have done something a little bit more original.
Yeah. All right. Let's get on with the top fives. I like this top five. I think this is a really interesting discussion. So any of you have any preferences of where you want your spot to fall here?
Nope.
I'm easy. I'll go first if you guys want.
All right. You got any criteria?
I do. I have three pieces of criteria. In order to qualify as unexpectedly good, I said that it had to be based on some previously known interpretation or performance. Okay. So based on a book or in a remake where we've seen somebody else do it, so that we had some sort of target. I said it had to be a performance from an obviously bad actor or non-actor, or that it had to be a good performance following a slew of very bad performances, which will make a lot of sense with this, with my number five. So I just had to meet one of those three. So my number five was Nicolas Cage in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Oh, that's a great pick.
Eight terrible movies. I mean, I guess maybe the adaptation would have been the last good movie he made before this. I remember Chapin was saying, "You got to see this movie. You got to see this movie," and I hadn't seen it. And I've only seen bits and pieces of the first one, but I didn't go in with very high hopes given what I knew about the story. And he was just incredible in it. It's not the best movie in the world, but the performance is so good, and it's just really visceral. And you know, it's the perfect performance for someone like Nicolas Cage to play, because it's like one of those things where he's sort of playing with house money. He doesn't really have anything to lose, so he can really just go super Nicolas Cage on it.
I'm glad one of us brought up Nicolas Cage, because I did see, kind of researching this, a lot of people bringing him up, and I'm of the, you know, the belief that Nicolas Cage has been so good in enough things that I forgive his shortcomings. You know, he does make some bad movies, but I mean, if you look at movies like Leaving Las Vegas and Adaptation and Bad Lieutenant, and among others, you know, he's a great actor. He just chooses bad roles and is bad in some of them. So he didn't make my list for that reason, because I mean, among other criteria that I had, but I'm glad that someone brought him up. And you're right, he is really good in that movie.
Nice. So that's my number five.
Chapin.
Okay.
Emmys.
This was a hard list for me. I don't have a whole lot of material, so I'll just go ahead. The first thing that came to mind, and it kind of ties in with our previous discussion, was Zachary Quinto in Star Trek
nice.
As Spock. I didn't really know much about Zachary Quinto before I saw that movie, but I, for some reason, had low expectations. I don't know why. He seemed kind of serious and... he plays that villain in Heroes, which I think I've seen clips of, but I thought he was really surprisingly good as Spock, and that whole movie surprised me, so that works.
Yeah, I thought that movie was pretty good. The only other thing I've ever seen him in was Margin Call.
Oh yeah, which, yeah. He was good in that too.
I guess he was good in that. Yeah, but I mean, that was another one of those weird movies where, like, how do you judge that movie? It's just a bunch of people being like pointing at numbers and dramatic, so
but I thought that movie was surprising.
I guess he pulled that off. I mean, it was entertaining, sure, yeah. All right, so I kind of have a lot of criteria here, because aspects of this list are tricky. So in a sense, I tried to pretend that I hadn't heard any critical response to a performance before seeing it. So does that make sense? Like, if I heard somebody was really good in a movie, obviously I wouldn't be surprised to see that they were good. So I tried to pretend that I didn't hear that picking this list. So just looking at it broadly, I would say, like, I'm surprised this person was good, regardless of how I felt going in. Regardless of that, because that's hard to do, there's not really a whole lot of old movies on this list.
Right, of course.
I also...
Oh,
I
didn't Lee, you're breaking any... up there with your mic. Sorry.
Okay, hang on.
I'm noting the time so I can delete it. 51, 54.
All right. I also did that. I couldn't have any like no-name actors who just came out of nowhere with a great performance that surprised you. But I didn't really have just good performances from bad actors. It was more along the lines of just being surprised that they were good in a certain role. Yeah. And then the last thing is it couldn't be the Kate Hudson thing where it's like your first movie and you're really great and then you've been bad ever since. Like, she was great and Almost Famous.
Yeah.
So I couldn't like use hindsight and say like, wow, how is she so good? She sucks and everything else. Yeah, so all that being said, my number five is Jonah Hill as Peter Brand in Moneyball.
Ah, nice.
Respect.
You wouldn't have pegged him even to be in that movie, never mind give a good performance.
Good one.
That's very, very good pick. Okay, my number four was Daniel Craig as Mikhail Blomqvist in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And being a unabashed super fan of the story, the books, and the Swedish version, I just couldn't wrap my head around James Bond playing this character, because whenever I think of Daniel Craig, even in a movie like Layer Cake, I just still think of him as kind of this badass with this swagger. And while the character of Mikhail has a little bit of swagger to him, you know, he's kind of an elder statesman sort of guy, and he's bookish, and he sort of gets, you know, put through the ringer in this movie. And I thought he was great. And in fact, I talked to Chapin about this somewhat recently. It's just, if he can make you forget that you're watching James Bond, then I think that that's pretty impressive. And
I didn't feel like he brought much to the performance. I felt like he was fine in the movie, but like I wouldn't say he was great by any means.
Right.
And I think that was my reaction when I first walked out, being like, I had no problem with him at all. Like, I feel like the casting was fine, and I'm not even sure I could pick someone who could have brought more. But like he.
And I think that's kind of how I feel. I just think that given where my expectations were, sure. I was pretty impressed. So
yeah.
So that's my number four.
Chapin.
Okay.
Hemmings.
Let's see here. All right. Well, this is kind of surprising in retrospect in a weird way, but my number four is Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights. Obviously, that was one of his first performances, but since then, he's played these kind of, you know, mostly tough guys, and he has. I feel like he has trouble kind of like breaking out of that, you know, tough guy Boston mentality, but. Supposedly, I've been wrong. You prove wrong with that intent, as Tyson explained to me. But I just thought that he just was able to just totally let go of any kind of, sense of, you know, that he just totally let everything go and put it all out there. And I thought he was so great, and he's yet to live up to that, I think. So that's a surprise performance in retrospect.
I agree. You know how I played. Free Love on the Free Love Freeway at my wedding.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So because I chose that one, I vetoed another selection, which would have been You've Got the Touch.
You've got the power!
I also don't think there's, like, a full version of that song, but
yeah,
I wanted to play so badly.
Yeah, John C. Reilly making those faces in the background. Awesome.
Yeah, and dancing. All right, my number four... we were talking about him before the podcast began. Jeremy is working with this fellow now. All are ashamed of him, but I have Adam Sandler as Barry Egan in Punch Drunk Love.
That's a great pick.
Yeah, good pick that.
I mean, I don't think that Adam Sandler is talentless, despite the joke I made to Jeremy. I mean, he refuses to use any such talent in any of his movies anymore. But, like, I think, I mean, he's great in Punch Drunk Love. And this is the movie that people went to see in the theater and didn't like because it wasn't an Adam Sandler movie. But I think over time, people have grown to respect both the movie and Sandler's performance.
Nice.
Nice. That is a good pick. Okay. My number three, again, much like my number four pick, I chose Jackie Earle Haley as Walter Kovacs, a.k.a. Rorschach in Watchmen. And I had only seen Jackie Earle Haley in Little Children, where he was, you know, he played a convicted child molester and was very different. But I was such a huge fan of the graphic novel, was geeking out so hard years in advance when I heard they were starting to make this movie. And of all the characters, I thought this would be the toughest one to cast because so much of the story rides on him working and being able to be, you know, believable and the voice and the mannerisms and everything. And I thought he was great. I thought he really stole the show. So that's my number three.
Nice. Okay. My number three, I'm gonna pull an audible here. Because I heard one of your guys' picks. I'm going for Brad Pitt in The Tree of Life as my number three. Brad Pitt is someone I just don't like in movies. I just think he's really bad, and I was just trying to think there about what I don't like about him. And I think he's someone who I feel is always just aware that the camera is on him. He seems to always be sort of posing for the camera. Not in like a physical way, but his acting is sort of inhibited by his awareness of him being on screen. Even in his more interesting roles, like in Jesse James, I felt that. But somehow, Malick and his genius was able to sort of find something in Brad Pitt that was interesting and just shot him in a way that he just wasn't aware of it. He just was, like, focused and did something completely different. It's something I'm sort of, like, as a burgeoning or as a amateur director myself, I'm sort of interested in how people are able to change actors so in such a manner. I don't understand it, and I don't even know if it's necessarily a director. Maybe it's just the material that brings it out from the actor himself, but I just thought that was an incredible aspect of that movie. So that's my number three.
Nice.
All right. My number three is Jamie Foxx in Collateral and in Ray, both released in 2004. I think in 2004 I would have just said Ray, but now he's so good in Collateral. And I remember just before those movies, like he was, all I remember him is it's just like this guy in the movie Booty Call and just kind of like goofy and just like a stand-up comedian that was making bad movies. And, you know, he had movies like Any Given Sunday and Ali in there beforehand, but like nothing major, like nothing that really stood out for him acting-wise. And then those two movies come along in the same year and like it proves that he's got like serious chops. He wins an Oscar. And so I just think it was very surprising at the time, to see such great performances from him. And again, in 2004, I would say Ray. Now it would just be like Collateral, I think is just his best performance by far. So I think that's just interesting that he was so good.
That's a very good pick. A really annoying pick. God damn it.
Was that your number one?
No, but I'm just saying I really like that pick.
Okay,
my number two, in line with my had to be a performance from a notoriously bad actor, non-actor, was Eminem as Jimmy Smith Jr., a.k.a. B-Rabbit, in 8 Mile.
I don't know if he's actually good in it.
Well, I think he's really good, but that's just me. What do I know about it?
Well, I do remember thinking when I saw it that he was good in it better than, and then everybody had said, like, oh, he's actually good in it, but you know, it does go to, he's just like kind of playing himself, and not that that's an easy thing to do necessarily. Just, like, yeah. I don't think people get enough credit who play themselves. Like Jerry Seinfeld played himself for years, and I think he's good in that show. So,
yeah.
You know, it's tricky to kind of define that performance.
Nice. Yep. So that's my number two.
Oh, Tyson, you gotta stop breathing into the mic, man.
That's not me. My mic is like 10 feet away from me.
I just heard you. You just finished it, and then you went, breathe right into it.
I think it was you, Tyson.
You talking?
Yes, right there. Okay, my number two. This is one I can't take credit for because I found it online, but I totally agree with. It's Actually, not, no, I don't want to. That's not a significant influence. Sorry. Okay. My number two is Ralph Fiennes in The Constant Gardener. A totally underrated movie that I love. And he plays this just like this, such like a super nice guy who everything bad happens to. And he just is like, just is a mensch the entire time. He just like deals with, takes everything in stride. Which is just the opposite of what every Ralph Fiennes character we have known and loved has done. And that's my number two.
Yeah, I don't remember that movie very well, but the way you describe his character is absolutely accurate. Like, you would not expect that type of performance from Amon Geth, or whatever his name is, in Schindler's List. All right, my number two is on this list for the same reason Jamie Foxx is on this list. Unlike Jamie Foxx, I don't think this actor has really done much with his good performance in this movie, but I got Marlon Wayans as Tyrone in Requiem for a Dream.
That's a good pick.
I mean, this is just like, you know, the Wayans brothers are just like the goofiest, talentless people out there, but, you know, clearly in Requiem for a Dream, like, Marlon Wayans shows that he's a good actor. He has the ability to pull it off. He just chooses not to.
Nice. Loving it. Okay, my number one was Heath Ledger as the Joker in The Dark Knight. And I only say that I didn't enjoy Heath Ledger. I remember when I heard that he was cast in this role, and I thought there would be so many people who would be better for it just because I hadn't seen him in anything that was remotely close to being able to do something like he ultimately did. And to give the performance that he gave was pretty incredible. So that's my number one.
I mean, it's a great pick. The reason I didn't put it on my list is because I couldn't remember my initial response when hearing that he was cast. I couldn't remember if I was like, yeah, he could pull that off, or that's weird, or like, this is no way. So I had to leave it off because I didn't know if it was surprising or not.
Yeah, see, I remember like frantically trying to find any sort of still of him, like just to see what he would look like, just because I didn't believe that he would be able to do it. So that's my number one. Jabin.
Nice. Okay, my number one is Denzel Washington in Man on Fire.
Interesting.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I don't remember that movie. I've seen it, but I don't remember it very well.
Oh, it's so good, Lee. You got to see it. It's so good.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a really sort of subtle and multifaceted performance in a typical Tony Scott movie. I think his performance really lends itself to making that movie a little bit more than it probably would have been.
And Ebert didn't mind it, but the critics did not.
No. But
like it.
In its defense, I just think that he plays this character with sort of unknown flaws. I mean, we know them a little bit, but he's got a past that isn't ever really explained. But and that's something Denzel, we sort of remember as playing these very noble characters and people who are very proud, and he just plays this man who at his core is a very good and decent man, but who just has had this has trouble dealing with his demons, and thus is sort of a damaged man. And I think it's an incredible performance.
All right, my number one is, it definitely falls into the situation where I kind of had to pretend I didn't hear anything about this performance going in, but I think you'll understand why it's my number one. Shape, and especially Tyson, I'm not totally sure if you've seen this movie, but it is Kirsten Dunst in Melancholia.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've seen it. We talked about it.
I said you'd seen it. I said I hadn't shown sure if Tyson had seen it.
Oh, sorry.
I have not.
I mean, she is amazingly good in this movie. It's just start to finish, it's just an unbelievable performance. Oscar-robbed performance, and I think an Oscar-nomination-robbed performance. In what is a great movie, regardless of what anybody on this podcast may have said. Considering what we had seen from her to that point, including the Spider-Man movies and Elizabethtown, she was, and it was an incredibly pleasant surprise how good she was in Melancholy.
Good pick.
Nice. Very good pick.
That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We'd like to encourage everyone to head over to the site, getyourfilmfix.com. Check out the articles, podcasts, webisodes. Feel free to subscribe or donate, or both. Actually, do both. It's best for you. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.